think it is this one that I mentioned about the Negro group. That's one of the ways in which we can contribute. Now, I'll talk a little later about the way in which some of the things in which the service committee is involved indirectly in this project. And then there are those more mundane changes. I remember, I expect others of you do here, when you first got a telephone. We had a telephone, and I was about 12 years old, put in our house. We had six other people on the line, so we didn't dare all talk ourselves clear out all the time. But nevertheless, that invention came in and changed the character of our community. And I remember very well when the first motor car came to me, little me out in Little Canyon. And we had a bright boy in our meeting, right in the center, and one of the agricultural college, and he had fixed up a little buggy with a little engine on it, and he drove the meeting in an automobile, Now that's in my time. Think what the automobile has done to it. In the lifetime of most of you here, not many of you are older than I am, but you somebody look at it, okay? And but I'm old enough for to limit the things that I like to do. During that time, we've also seen the airplane come and absorb a large proportion of the internal transportation of passengers and of passengers overseas around the world. And the decline of the rail. I went into New York, I remember, in 1910. There was no tunnel under the Hudson River, so the train landed at a dock down in the lower part of the city. And then we went over on a little ferry and got from there onto a streetcar pulled by horses. Now they had streetcars, they said, that were also that were run by electricity. But this is nothing phenomenal, it's just what happened. It changed our lives during my lifetime. When I was a farm boy in Kansas, about 65% of the population of the United States was involved in farming. Now, it's scarcely 10%, nearer 8 than 10. I suppose there is no change that has been so phenomenal, affecting family life and the whole of our social life, as that process of not people running away from the farm because they didn't like it necessarily, but there was more opportunity they thought to stay, or because there was very little need for them on the farm. Farming doesn't take very much except the ability to buy machines and operate them now. Then perhaps the most significant of all is the tremendous expansion of knowledge. It's double every 10 years at the present time. What in the world will our great-grandchildren do? They can't get more than a nibble at one corner of the knowledge that is available to them. Even now, I find that it is impossible for me to understand an algebra textbook that one of my grandchildren uses in high school. The whole way of teaching mathematics is by way of being changed. And one would have supposed that if 2 + 2 made 4, 100 years ago or 80 years ago when I was born, it would still make 4. But now you discover that that isn't true. That it may well be quite true that it's not true. so that the whole, not only the body of knowledge, but the character of knowledge has changed. Do you wonder, these are just some of the things that I wanted to mention as background, as reasons why we sometimes feel confused in the world in which we live, and why the younger generation, with all of the changes and complexities that come, feel even more confused than their parents. Or you can think of the social changes. I never remember as a growing boy anything about the problem of Negro and white living next to each other. We had them in the village where we traded. They lived next to each other and nobody raised any questions. Now, it's a great national problem. Can it be that color and white can live next to each other? Part of it, of course, is the tremendous number of Negroes who have come from the south, the north, the west, and we're a little scared of them. We're afraid they'll outdo us in competition. I think it's the real reason is that we don't like them so well, but they might outdo us in competition. I wonder sometimes if that isn't the reason. But anyway, this is a problem that emerges quite new and very important. Perhaps by no means the least important is that we have become conscious that people ought to think before they bring children into this world. We are rapidly becoming overpopulated. You get out on the desert here and you think it'll be a long time before standing room will be at a premium on the desert. But nevertheless, on the part of the globe that is possibly habitable by a human being, rapidly we are becoming overpopulated. It's not a nice subject to bring up in meetings. Do we believe in birth control or not? English friends have had quite a row about it, you know. There's some friends there, not here at the meeting, but some friends who, one of them, the leader of a private school, friend school, produced a pamphlet. And I expect some of you have read this pamphlet about the whole question of sex relations between boys and girls together in high school and college, in the general community, and the whole question of responsibility that people assume when they set up a family. How many children shall we have? And the tendency after the Second World War was not to raise that question, and now we have the population bubble country. But that's a temporary situation. I suppose that we're on the verge of the time when a natural point of discussion in a group of people like this will be things that would have embarrassed us terribly to have anybody dare to mention in a meeting circle of any kind in my boyhood, certainly. And even then, as I remember, the mention of it by my parents to me was very, very slender. My mother had some comprehension of the agony I went through, but my father, I think, very little. I excuse him because he was essentially himself an invalid. But now it's coming to be an important question. How shall we use this God-given talent of reproduction with wisdom and with concern? Of course, we're up against obstacles. I sit in Philadelphia on a committee appointed by the mayor to hear cases of alleged police brutality. And most of those cases are Negroes. I'm sorry to say, in spite of the fact that one out of five of our policemen is a Negro, still there is abuse. And we had a man, this little boy, come before us, and in the process of trying to get us facts of the case, I said to him, how many children do you have? and he said 21. And I said, that's a good sized family. Yes, he said, but I've got 17 grandchildren and I'm only 41. So we've got a long way to go yet. When you go into the community in which people have been forced to live, and with the prevalence of low moral standards in good many of those streets, one doesn't wonder what happened. So we have, not only just among upper class people, if we dare to call ourselves middle class or upper class, but among the general population, we develop a sense of responsibility about the population's problem. I'm not discussing the mechanics of it because I don't know enough to do that intelligently, and I don't think that that is the real obstacle. The real obstacle is lack of concern. This man didn't seem the slightest shock at the fact that he had 21 children. I didn't ask him, and I was just a little embarrassed to push too far how many wives that is involved. I wouldn't be surprised if there's only one, because he seemed a very respectable person. Another thing that one finds is that women come often to us without slightest embarrassment, saying, you know, I'm in the household without men, and I've got so many children by two or three different men. That is one of the penalties we're paying for the great rush to the city of people who have no preparation for living in the city. And we haven't solved the problem of how to prepare them to live. There are some devices, of course, that have been extremely useful. I'm not here to discuss those tonight. But that's one of the very pressing and pertinent problems. That the character of our population has changed. If we had been born 100 years ago, we would have been dead 75 years ago. We would have died at the 30, when we were about 30 or 35. That would have been the average age length. Now, the average age length, I'm sorry to say, is higher for women than it is for men. So really, you have a good chance. It's about 70 for both of us, but it's a little higher for men. It's gone up during my lifetime from about 35 to 70. That makes a lot more old people like ourselves, who are conservative and tend to hold back and don't want things to move. The nice climate of Arizona and California induce us to come and enjoy that climate. And it's so pleasant that we don't want things to change. Now that's one of the problems that we have to face in the world in which we live, is the different character of the population of people. I'm not talking about their morals and ethics now, but just as human beings, the natural phenomenon. Suppose we turn now to how different things look in the world outside. I first went to England in 1912. Was it 1912. Great Britain ruled the waves. Britannia ruled the waves. She was the great imperial power in the world. Second to her was Germany. Third was France. Fourth was, and away down the scale, was the United States, a small power in terms of general influence in the world. That's not saying that there was anything wrong with it, but we were still conquering a continent instead of trying to conquer the other parts of the world. We were not an imperial power. In my lifetime, which is not a very long time, Great Britain has ceased to be a world power. France has certainly ceased to be a world power, even though she's trying to recover that capacity, and I think inevitably will fail. Spain I left out, but Spain long since disappeared as a world power. Instead of all of this has come the United States, a world power, the USSR, a world power, the next world power will be China. That will be a complicated world in which your children and mine will live. And we have to begin to think and have to begin to plan against that kind of a background rather than assuming that our grandchildren will be the inheritors not only of this continent but of a great political power and influence in the world. Now, I realize I'm entering a little bit into prophecy, but not very much. I think it's pretty obvious that it's obvious now that Russia and the United States are the two great powers. That's obvious. I think it's pretty obvious that China will, before the younger generation that's in this room reaches maturity, will be the third great power. Their goals and ideals are different from ours. I'm not judging whether they're bad or good, but they're very different from ours. And therefore, it's important for us to know them. Just in passing, I would like to say, I think one of the most important things that could happen in the world at this time would be for some sort of contact to be established between China and the Western world. There is a little contact with Great Britain, a little bit with France, a little bit with Poland, but not very much. The embassies there are pretty impotent. In both the Western embassies in China and the representatives of China in these embassies. On the other hand, China gains daily in recognition in the world of a power that you can't ignore, not only just because she created the bomb and will build a lot more, but because of her massive population, of the emphasis, interestingly enough, that has been put in Chinese life on education, brought there not only by the missionary, long before the missionary entered, was the emphasis on the training of the mind by the great forebears in China, the great grandfathers of China. Then came the missionary emphasis, which added a great deal to that. And now comes the denial of the religious side of the mission, but the absorption of the virtues that they brought in terms of education. Well, that is present enough to say about the change. There was one more comment, another factor that has come into it, which is now, of course, struggling against very great odds and difficulties, the United Nations, in which all of the countries, the communist countries, participate. I think that's right, all the communist countries except China. Now that's the fact that Great Britain, that France, that Spain, that Germany, with a great deal of culture and background, emphasis on education, emphasis on control of other parts of the country, of the world, that is past or is passing, and that new struggles for central control, predominant control of the world in which we live, has centered in new countries, one in the West, one in the East, two in the East, I suppose, if you say China and Russia are in the East. And with very widely different ideas and ideals in many respects. So that in thinking ahead as to what is the responsibility of a Christian group in this country, it has its immediate responsibility. I don't want to take one iota from the responsibility to the things in the community in which we live, but the milieu, the climate in which we from here on out are going to live is a gradually changing, complex climate. How can we prepare to live in it? Well, there's another factor that I think I ought to mention, and I think that many of us are still struggling to know how to answer this question. What does it mean to us as Christians that now great powers have emerged, new countries have emerged that have totally different religions from our own, or, unless you call atheism religion, no religion at all? I think it's fair to say that by and large, the growing generation of Russians feel no loss at the church being very much the mother and influence in the state. The church is allowed to exist and deeply appreciated by those who attend it. It is limited and restricted in its operation. It can participate in no social work. It's for worship only. And for those who are members of the church, you can't go out and proselyte. Whether it's the Orthodox Church or the Protestant Church, which is called their Baptist Church. During the war, they brought them all together under the Baptist flag. And we've attended both services in both groups. One is deeply impressed with the significance of religious faith to the people who worship in these churches. And while they're small relative to the population, the church buildings and bells are crowded with roars. 2,000 people in the Baptist church, 5 services on Sunday, and all of them crowded with every seat taken and all the aisles filled with standing people and with windows around the edge. When we were there, people standing at the windows listening in. It was in June, ninth day, and they could hear what was going on. The Orthodox Church had 5,000 or 6,000 people in the cathedral, great choir and a beautiful service. And we talked with the bishop, who has been a bishop, he's since died. But by and large, the Russian younger generation was not there. The younger generation is growing up without the influence of religion. What does that mean to us? And what can we do about it? Do we cut ourselves off and say they're naughty, they're wicked, they are pagans? Or do we say, we want to know, Now, right or wrongly, the service committee, I can't say that all friends have done this, but I think many friends would agree, this is the line to take, service committee has taken the line that one of the things we ought to do is to establish contact back and forth between the Russians and ourselves. That we ought to know what gives meaning to life to them. They're not stupid, and they're not, they've got plenty of people that are wicked, but I mean they're not wicked people who are out to do things that are antisocial. They're interested in the progress of this country to which they are extremely loyal. And yet, when you talk religion, they feel no sense of need of religion. Now, how are we going to validate? How are we going to validate to them the significance that we find, or feel that we find, in religious faith? Or you take a different situation. We have quite a program of various forms of social work in India, mostly working with Hindus. In Pakistan, all together working with Muslims. And in other parts of the world, working alongside and with them on the problems that are central to them. We do not go, whether this is right or wrong, the service committee does not go for the purpose of proselyting. We go because they've asked us to come. We want what you have to give. We go and we live and we work among them. We have our own worship and they're welcome to come. But we do not put the heat on to become Christians. If we did, we very soon would change the character of our relation with them. The Indian government would not invite us back, certainly, as they have time again, for our various projects in India. And the same is true, even more true, I should think, in Pakistan. At the same time, there is often indication of a real interest in what makes us tick. Why in the world do you come all this way at your expense to do these things with us? You didn't have to come, you're volunteers, you almost sometimes say you're foolish, but you're loving. It's this kind of world that is less complicated than it was in the day when I first knew about sending people abroad. They went abroad as missionaries. They went abroad to carry the gospel, to save the souls of the people that were going otherwise to be lost. Now that was clear and simple. I don't mean it was easy by any means. I have the greatest of respect for the problems that the missionaries had to put up with. But it was a clear-cut definition of object. Now, as I was saying this morning, I guess I'll repeat a little bit for those of you who come from the other meetings. Now we find that the people who have responded to this gospel message are faced with the fact that they have to help run a government, a self-supporting government. Self-operating government, particularly in Kenya, I'm talking about now, and some of the leading officials in that government are members of this Society of Friends. We've been very, very fortunate in our group that we have at the United Nations, the Friends have made there, the Service Committee and Friends Service Council in London, maintain at the United Nations in getting acquainted with leaders of the delegation in Kenya. He is a member of the Society of Friends, and one of the other members, a younger member of the delegation, is a member of the Society of Friends. The foreign minister is a member of the Society of Friends. The great powers outside of Kenyatta, who is a Christian, made Christian while he was a member of the Mau Mau tribe, and caused all that disturbance. While he was in prison, he became a Christian. Well, he's a kind of an awkward Christian. He just doesn't know exactly what this means in applying it to the affairs of state. But someone who has a steady hand, whose religious life has been interpreted here in terms of community relations, relations with the local government or the national government, whatever it may be, to the sensitiveness to the application of our religion in political terms. There's a person of priceless value. Although he's a white skin, he goes over and becomes a help. I suppose the greatest help to the present government of Kenya is a man named John Martin, who is an English, a young Englishman, very well informed, an Oxford graduate, went there not quite knowing what he was going to do. Settled in Kenya, and there he is now, the consultant of Kenyatta and to other members of the government, trying to objectively help them to develop the kind of situation that they want. That's what the tendency is for the modern missionary to have to meet. Could have used Japan also as an illustration, but I'll talk too long if I didn't forget. That's one of my great troubles. Well, Now let's think a little bit about the private service committee representing, I don't mean officially, we're officially a separate corporation. And some people object to that, but it gives us the kind of freedom which we wouldn't have if we represented, what is it, that's government, how many meetings there are, there's an awful lot of them. And they have wide different views of what should be done. We came into existence, of course, around the peace testimony in 1917 to provide alternative service for those who were exempt from war. Well, that seemed simple and a short-lived adventure. And it called forth the talents of some of the very ablest of the members of the Society of Friends across the continent. But in the meantime, other things have developed. I suppose the best known, the one operation for which we are best known, probably, is the tariff meeting in Germany. I went to the office down here, in the service committee office in Center City, and there was a German girl, German-speaking girl, who was secretary to Jim DeWeese. And I said, when did you leave Germany? And she told me. And I said, were you there in the early 20s? Oh, yes. She said, I ate Quaker food. My life was saved by eating Quaker food in the early 20s. Well, now, when you go to Germany, especially representing the service committee, you realize what a valuable asset that is in the background. That we came not to proselyte them, not to say, if you will become a Quaker, we'll give you some wheat or something or other to eat. We came because of it.